On episode 460 of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we bring back Dr. Jason Fung and discuss his new book, The Cancer Code, A Revolutionary New Understanding of a Medical Mystery. You can find the full show notes for this episode at 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/460.
Have you decided you're ready to make a change? To reclaim your health and fitness? The 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is here for you. I'm your host, Alan Meisner. I'm an NSAM certified personal trainer with a specialization in corrective exercise and fitness nutrition. Let me be your coach as you find your way on your health and fitness journey. All right, let's go.
Are you struggling to get results from your exercise and diet? Spinning your wheels? Or maybe you just really don't know where to start, but you want to start. The pandemic has made it clear we can't afford to not do something to improve our health. In fact, a recent study showed that obese people spend over $1,400 more per year on medical care and prescriptions. I'm here to help. I've helped hundreds of people over 40 lose weight and get more fit with 40 Plus Fitness online personal training. And now it's your turn. When you're over 40, you need to train smart and eat smart if you want to shed the weight and get stronger. Through the monthly group coaching call, the monthly one-on-one coaching call, and the 40 Plus Fitness app, I'll guide you step by step so you get results fast and learn how to keep it off. I'm so confident in 40 Plus Fitness online personal training that I offer a 40-day money-back guarantee. You won't find another personal trainer or wellness coach that does that. I take all the risks because I know I can help you. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start and get started today. That's 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start. In honor of Veterans Day, I'm offering a 20% discount on 40 Plus Fitness group training to all veterans with the coupon code VETERAN. This offer will be valid into the end of November. 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/start. Have you ever struggled to hit your health goals during the holidays? Check out 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/summit. I'm joining over 15 amazing experts to support you in creating a game plan to make this year's holidays your healthiest yet. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/summit, and that will take you to the Healthy Holidays, How to Eat Guilt-Free and Exceed Your Fitness Goals online event. Check it out today. You don't want to miss this. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/summit. Raz, how you doing?
Good. How are you today, Alan?
I'm doing really well. I'm doing well. I'm excited the conversation that the interview we're going to have today with Dr. Fung, and his book's called The Cancer Code. And, it's a big problem. So I'm pretty excited about the conversation. You know, as we're getting into this, as this goes live, I'm going to be in North Carolina visiting my mom, the last leg, sort of last leg of our trip through the States. So kind of exciting, you know, a couple of weeks ago, then we got loaded all of our stuff in a truck. So it's now in a cargo container headed down to Panama. So we'll get down there. I'll have a lot of gym stuff to sort through and a rack to build and all that. And I saw the picture that you posted on the group of your rack. So, I'm jonesing to get that thing going down there because it's a much better rack than the one I have.
Nice. That'll be awesome.
So how are things going up there?
Good, good. Mike and I are doing our puppy training. So puppy is learning good tricks from Stella and vice versa, actually. Stella is learning how to be a good dog to a puppy. So they're becoming fast friends and they've been really entertaining for us lately, which is timely this time of year. So yeah, everything's good here.
Yeah. A lot of times when you get a puppy, an older dog kind of livens up a little bit more playful than they would have been otherwise.
Absolutely. I was actually really surprised at how well she's taken to having a little sibling. She's teasing her with toys and they're just really entertaining each other, which has been a real treat to watch.
Cool. All right. So let's get into the episode with Dr. Fung. Our guest today is a physician, author, and researcher. His groundbreaking science-based books, The Diabetes Code, The Obesity Code, and The Complete Guide to Fasting have sold over 1 million copies and challenged the conventional wisdom about type 2 diabetes, weight loss, and fasting. He is also the co-founder of The Fasting Method, a program to help people lose weight and reverse type 2 diabetes naturally with fasting. With no further ado, Here's Dr. Jason Fung. Dr. Fung, welcome to 40 Plus Fitness.
Thanks for having me here. Great to be back.
You're the kind of guest that I just love having on the show because you do your homework. And after you've done your homework and you have your case, which you state in one of your books, I've had you I've covered you for the obesity code, your complete guide to fasting, and then had Megan on for the diabetes code. But you do your homework, and then once you have your statement, it's like, man, you're just like a wolf. You're on it, man. And I just love your approach to these things because people aren't always talking about this. And a lot of people don't know about this. And the book we're going to talk about today is called The Cancer Code, A Revolutionary New Understanding of a Medical Mystery. And it's a part of your wellness code trio, I guess, at this point. And like I said, I was going through the book and I'm like, this is completely fascinating and scary because this is not what my paradigm of cancer was. My paradigm was that it's growing and we got to get it out of there any way we can. But we don't understand cancer nearly as much as I thought we did. But we're getting there.
Yeah. And I think that these things are very important to understand because a lot of times specialists like, you know, doctors and oncologists and researchers, they get caught in the sort of weeds of, you know, the minutiae, which is not to say that they're not important. Like, you know, should you use this drug versus this drug? I mean, those questions are clearly important, but the frame is often missing in terms of, you know, how are we looking at this problem as a whole? And it gets into the same sorts of things as the obesity code and the diabetes code, which is that, you know, in obesity medicine, sort of you get locked into this frame of calories, calories, calories. Then you start talking about, oh, this food versus this food, but your frame is still defined by calories as opposed to sort of hormonal responses and so on. And that's the reason it's important. Same thing with type 2 diabetes. You get locked into this frame where it's all about blood glucose. And you forget that the disease is not about blood glucose, right? That was the result of the disease. It's not the cause of the disease. It's not the disease. So it's the same thing in cancer where people often get sort of really focused on these very small questions and sort of leave the big questions of what cancer actually is, that sort of frame, unanswered. And it's important because the way you frame a question has huge implications, you know, as to everything that sort of goes on afterwards. So not that these questions are not important, but you have to understand both. And this is talking about the frames or the paradigms of cancer and how you approach the disease. And it's one of these things that's been changing over time because the real question we're trying to answer here, and this is the book is sort of an exploration of how far we've come, which is not to say that there's not going to be changes in the future, right? It may change in 20 years. That's clearly a possibility. But where we are now and how much it's changed really in the last sort of 10 years, this idea of cancer, because the question we're trying to ask is, what is cancer? What is the actual disease that we are trying to treat? Because if you don't know that, then you're sort of guessing a little bit at treatments. So for the last, say, 50 years, the main paradigm of cancer is a disease that grows. And then you say, well, why is this disease growing? Why is this tumor growing? And the answer to that, if you ask, you know, a lot of people, it'd be like, oh, it's a disease where you have these random genetic mutations which cause excessive growth. So say you take a disease like lung cancer, you say, okay, well, we know that tobacco smoking is a cause of lung cancer. And tobacco smoke is a mutagen. That is, it damages genes and causes mutations. And that and a chance mutation in a growth-causing gene will accelerate growth. And that's been our sort of understanding of cancer for this, you know, entire time. But there's a huge problem with that paradigm of cancer, which is that the data simply didn't fit that sort of paradigm. So where we were sort of 20 years ago, was that, okay, so now we know that there's a mutation in a gene. So you take breast cancer, you say, oh, let's look at the BRCA gene, or colon cancer, let's look at this gene. So now that we identified this paradigm, we say there's a couple of mutations, two, three, four mutations. So the initial paradigm was, okay, we have one mutation, one cancer. Block that mutation, get rid of that cancer. And it worked well for some stuff, right? So CML was a great case where we did that. And it worked extremely well. Then clearly most cancers were not one gene. So then they said, well, it's two or three or four genes. So therefore, if your paradigm is that you have two or three or four genes which are mutated due to random, you know, genetic mutation, then let's find those two or three or four genes and we'll block them with drugs. And then we'll do fine, we'll cure cancer. And that's where we were sort of 20 to 30 years ago, where we had this huge optimism that we were going to develop great new genetic treatments of drugs that were going to cure cancer and wipe it off the map. And it's all predicated on this frame, this paradigm, that this is what we're dealing with. So we started to look for these genes. So we had the Human Genome Project, which, you know, finished up around 2000. So we sequenced the genes of an entire, you know, human genome. And that was a monumental accomplishment. And at the time we thought, well, now we're going to find all these cancer-causing genes and figure it out. But we didn't. So then they did something further, which is called the Cancer Genome Atlas, which was that the ability to sequence human genomes had the technology improved so much by that time that you could sequence many, many, many genes. Like you could go sequence your gene for like $50 sort of thing at 23andMe or whatever it is, right? So the technology went from, you know, multiple labs in 2000 with multi-million dollar budgets to like you could go to a company and get your gene sequenced today. So by that time, the human genome, project wound up, we did this further thing where we sequenced sort of thousands and thousands of genomes of cancer patients. So we took the cancer and we sequenced the genome. So then it's like, okay, well, we take like a 50 or 100 breast cancers, sequence them, find that one or two or three genes that's causing it, and boom, we're going to get some drugs to block them. So that was sort of the paradigm from 2000 to say 2010. By the time the human the Cancer Genome Atlas finished, that paradigm was sort of shattered. It was like blown out of the water because we were not finding two or three or four mutations in a cancer genome. We were finding hundreds and millions of gene mutations. So that is, if you take a cancer such as colorectal cancer, for example, one person with, person A with colorectal cancer might have not two or three or four genes that were mutated, might have 80 that are mutated, okay? And so that's a number that is far out. Like you can't develop 80 drugs and give them all to that patient. It's just so far out of what we can do with cancer therapeutics. The problem was also that if you had the very next patient that you saw with the exact same identical appearing colorectal cancer, say it's in the same place, it's stage three, same metastasis, everything exactly the same clinically, they would have 80 mutations or 100 mutations, and they would be completely different than person A. So you needed 80 or 100 drugs for person A and 80 to 100 drugs that were completely different for person B. Well, that's just not doable. So at last count that I saw in 2018, there was close to, I think, 6 million mutations identified in cancers. So it's just this genetic paradigm of cancer just sort of got blown out of the water, because how can two genomes with, say, 80 to 100 different mutations, like they differed at many, many, many places, how can they appear exactly the same? Like, what is it that we're dealing with? We're obviously not dealing with anything random, because remember, this is the whole premise of the so-called somatic mutation theory, which was that paradigm that we were using, is that it's just this chance mutation in a growth growth-causing gene. So you randomly mutate this growth gene, it grows. And that's why it grows, right? But that wasn't the case. You had all different mutations in all different genes, yet they were appearing identical. So there's nothing random about this. That is, if you think about it, it makes sense, because if you take a colon cancer from, you know, a 40-year-old black woman today, compared to a colon cancer from a Japanese man in the 1920s, those two situations are very different, but those colorectal cancers appear exactly the same. Yet they evolve differently from that Japanese man and that black woman. Like, they've evolved completely independently, yet they've appeared the same, which is an interesting sort of conundrum. Because if you think that cancer is this sort of random genetic mutation, how does everything end up looking the same? And that's a real problem. So by the 2010s, this sort of random genetic mutation idea of cancer genetics was sort of blown out of the sky. And it had a lot of implications, because what we saw, of course, was that from 2000, when there's this huge optimism with all these new drugs, the amount of new drugs that have really seriously impacted cancer, that is significantly improved, you know, the lives of cancer patients, is sort of dwindling rapidly. So yes, there are new drugs, but if you look at the actual studies of these drugs, and some of them are fantastically expensive, you know, you're talking $100,000 a year, $200,000 a year for some of these drugs. The thing is that if you look at how effective they are, they're sort of like, well, they're either completely ineffective at adding months of life to somebody's expected prognosis, to sort of barely in improving the life. So I think one study showed that on average, if you take all of these recent drugs, they improve the prognosis, the life expectancy, by an average of like 2.1 months or something like that. It was really, really, really bad. And I think that's something that we have to sort of look at, because if these drugs are so poor, then there must be sort of this better way of looking at this disease, so that we can identify new drugs, because we're sort of 20, 25 years into this genetic paradigm. And if you go to the American Cancer Society website, for example, you'll still read, what is cancer? Cancer is a genetic disease of mutations. It's like, well, that paradigm didn't actually help anybody. It's actually been a giant dead end. Not to say it's a waste of time, because obviously this is a learning process. But now, in the sort of last 8 or 10 years, there's been this new sort of idea of what cancer is, how it came to be, that is leading to sort of more improved treatments. And that's the sort of story that I sort of write about, is that what is this new thinking about cancer, so that we can improve people's lives, prevent cancer, identify more promising areas of research, that kind of thing. And that's the sort of evolutionary paradigm of cancer, that cancer is a disease that evolves, not a disease of random genetic mutations.
Yeah, in one of the things that you got into in the book is in helping us understand what cancer is, you identified 8 hallmarks of cancer, and then you further refined that down to 4 main characteristics. Do you mind going through that real quick? Because that, for me, was a real good frame to kind of understand when we're talking about cancer. And then as you took that forward, it's like, what else is like this? And you kind of took it, like you said, in that evolution, which I kind of read as a de-evolution, back to, basic or atavism. But it's one of those things where it's a new organism. I mean, it's almost its own thing. Can you kind of talk through that?
Yeah, exactly. So this is what we're it's an interesting sort of way we came to this, because cancer, we know, originates from our own cells, right? So when you have lung cancer, it came from your own lung cell. When you have liver cancer, it came from your own liver cell. It's not some extrinsic thing that, like an infection or a virus or something. It's something that came from your own body, but now somehow became perverted. So there's lots of different types of cancers, and there's, you know, lung cancer and liver cancer and breast cancer and so on. And they're all different in a lot of ways. So that's the way that we've always treated them. So you look at things like breast cancer and you have a different staging system compared to like liver cancer or colorectal cancer. Different things are important for different cancers. So one of the things that happened in about year 2000, which was a big change, was this sort of codification, not of how cancers are different, but how cancers are the same. And it's an interesting story because the researchers, and it's actually one of the most highly cited research papers in oncology. So this is the sort of one paper that everybody reads. And it's called The Hallmarks of Cancer, and it was published in 2001. And when you read about the story, it's like the researchers themselves didn't actually think much at the time about the paper. They said, well, you know, they're very smart researchers. And what they did was they said, hey, like, we all talk about the differences between cancers, but nobody talks about the similarities between cancers. So we should write a paper. So they wrote a paper about it. And it became the most important piece of research in a long time, because when you look at the sort of lumper splitter problem, so in biology, you can either lump things together or you can split them apart. And this has important implications because you can lump things together, like, okay, an apple and orange are two pieces of fruit, so they're fruit. Or you can split them apart and say apples and oranges are different because they're different. You know, one is, you know, like this, it's round, it's orange, and so on. So you can lump them together, you can split them apart. So cancer had always been a splitter. So you say breast cancer stage one versus colorectal cancer stage four, they're different. And what you do when you split things apart is that you actually highlight their differences and you sort of investigate further how they're different. When you lump them together and say they're fruit, then you can say, well, fruit share these two characteristics. So it's the same thing in cancer. So what they're doing, instead of being splitters, they were sort of lumpers and said, let's look at all cancers and say, what is it about cancer that is similar between breast and colorectal and leukemia and all these different types of cancer? So they came up with eight sort of characteristics, which is a great starting point, because in order to understand cancer, not just breast cancer or not just leukemia, but cancer, you have to know what it is. And nobody had sort of defined that. So the best sort of scientific definition of what cancer is could be defined by these eight hallmarks, which is is a little bit technical, but I break it down into something a little bit more sort of simple to understand, which is that one, these cancers, so cancer as opposed to normal cells, and this is sort of irrespective of what type of cancer, they grow. So cells don't normally grow, tissues do not normally grow. So your liver doesn't continue to grow and grow and grow until it's sort of the size of a small boulder, because it's going to impact everything else. And that's what's sort of partially what's so deadly about cancer. So they grow. Second thing is that they move around. So again, this is not something that happens in normal cells. So when you consider a sort of lung cell versus a lung cancer cell, the lung cell never moves around. It's always anchored to the lung, whereas a lung cancer cell moves around the body. It can go anywhere, and that's why it kills you, because it metastasizes to the liver, to wherever. So it grows and moves around. Third is that it's immortal. So immortality, again, is not something we see in normal cells. So this is called the Hayflick limit, and this has been talked about a lot in the longevity sphere, but the Hayflick limit is basically, if you take a human cell, so you take your lung cell, and you try to grow it, it will split into two daughter cells. That's how cells grow, they divide. But you can't do that sort of indefinitely. So when you get to a certain number of replications, that cell will no longer replicate. And we know how this works. So when cells divide, the genetic material sort of splits in two, and and that's what you get. But at the end of each chromosome, which is where all this genetic material is, there's a telomere. And a telomere is this sort of cap on the end of the chromosome, and every time you replicate, it sort of shaves off one. So in other words, every time the cell divides, the telomere cap gets a little smaller. And it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. When it goes away, you can no longer divide. And so that was sort of Nobel Prize winning material 20 or 30 years ago. So, but it's another way that cancer cells are different than normal cells. And the fourth way that they differ is that they use a different way of generating energy, which is very anomalous. And it's very interesting because it's anomalous. And that's the Warburg effect. That is, there's the cancer's cells and normal cells generate energy, cellular energy, differently. So when we normal cells generate energy, we use glucose in a process called oxidative phosphorylation, which means that we take oxygen, we take glucose, we burn them together, and you get energy. Okay, so we measure cellular energy as ATP, and you get 36 ATP per glucose in this oxidative phosphorylation. So you get lots of energy. But cancer cells don't do that. And it's very anomalous because cancer cells, which are growing and moving and stuff, you think that they need a lot of energy. So you'd think that they'd use oxidative phosphorylation, but they don't. They actually use glycolysis, where you take the glucose and you metabolize it through a different pathway called glycolysis, and you get 2 ATP and lactic acid. So this is, you know, all cells can do this. So when you sprint, for example, and you run and you can't get enough oxygen in your muscles, they generate anaerobic energy, which is glycolysis, which is gets you all this lactic acid, which gives you the muscle burn and all this sort of stuff. But the point is that you get a lot less energy, but you generate it more quickly. So that's the trade-off. And cancer cells almost always use this sort of less efficient way of generating energy. At the same time that we know cancer cells need a lot of energy. So it's like, that is very, very anomalous. And those are the ways that cancers all stay the same. And any theory of cancer as to what is cancer, so we take a paradigm like, okay, cancer is this random collection of genetic mutations that happens to kill you. Well, it doesn't explain anything of why cancers grow. Like, it does in that you have the growth gene, but why they're immortal, like how does it affect the telomeres? Why do they move around? Because to move around, you know, you have adhesion molecules, for example, you have blood cells which are trying to kill you. Like, the body has defenses against the lung cell moving around the body. If the lung cell detaches and tries to move around the body, it'll get slaughtered. So these sort of genetic mutation, random genetic mutations, doesn't explain why. Why is it going to grow? Why is it immortal? Why is it moving around? Why is it using a Warburg effect? Because each of these hallmarks, and those are just sort of characteristics, those are not the actual hallmarks, but each of these characteristics requires many, many, many genetic mutations to make it happen. So why is every cancer independently, so every cancer in history for the last, you know, 5,000 years of humanity where cancer has existed, each cancer has independently sort of reinvented the wheel, right? Because the cancer of, you know, the Persian queen Atossa in the year, you know, 20 AD or whatever, has reinvented the wheel to develop all these characteristics just as the person in 2020 has. How is that, right? That's a very interesting question that needs to be answered. And the answer is that this is sort of an evolutionary process. And as you say, it's not a forward evolutionary process. It's actually a backwards evolutionary process. And that's how we get to there, by understanding what it is that cancer is doing.
This episode of the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast is sponsored by Himalaya Botanique Toothpaste. Over the years, I've tried several natural toothpastes to reduce my exposure to chemicals like fluoride and artificial flavors. They often feel like and taste like I'm brushing my teeth with dirt. One was actually made out of clay. None of them foamed up and left my teeth feeling clean. Now I use Himalaya Botanique toothpaste. Himalaya Botanique is a toothpaste that's free from fluoride, SLS, and artificial colors and flavors. But unlike other similar toothpastes, they don't compromise on flavor or performance. Himalaya toothpaste is always bursting with foam and flavor. Interested in trying it yourself? As a 40 Plus Fitness podcast listener, you'll get 20% off of Himalaya Botanique toothpaste on Amazon with the discount code 40PlusFit. That's FORTYPLUSFIT. Go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/toothpaste, and I'll forward you on to Himalaya Botanique toothpaste on Amazon. And don't forget to plug in your discount code 40PLUSFIT to get 20% off.
You know, one of the things that came out of this is, you know, when I was thinking about the treatment, so, you know, you hear a friend is going in for chemo or you hear they're going in for surgery. And, you know, the principle is how do we reduce the tumor size? How do we get rid of the tumor? How do we make sure we got it all? And that's because we know that, you know, cancer has the opportunity to metastasize and spread, which is how it tends to kill most of us, because we'll get a cancer that's not necessarily deadly, and then it's going to spread to the bone or to the heart, I mean, to the brain or to the liver, and then it is something that could absolutely kill us. Why is there still a big focus on tumor size when that's not really what's going to preserve us? That's not really going to get rid of cancer. It just seems that that's, you know, still the paradigm of most of what I hear in treatments is we need to get the tumor size down. If we get the tumor size down, we're winning.
Yeah, and I think it comes back to these sort of old paradigms, which is to the people who are thinking, well, this is a disease of random genetic mutations, which causes it to grow. So the less growth you have, the better you're doing, sort of thing, as opposed to saying, where are we in this sort of evolutionary process of cancer development? That is to say that cancer is, so we focus on this sort of growth, and it's easy to measure. So therefore, it's easy to put a number on it, and a regulatory agency such as the FDA can sort of say, okay, well, that's where we go. It's sort of what's led us to this sort of impasse of how we got so many marginally useful drugs at this point, like fantastically expensive, but marginally useful because of this sort of focus on size. Like, the focus on size is, you know, extremely misguided, because we know that it's not the size of the tumor that kills you. So about 90% of the deadliness of cancer is the fact that it moves around. So that's metastasis. When a cancer metastasizes, your prognosis becomes very, very poor. So you have benign cancers like lipomas, for example, that grow very large, or cysts grow very large. It doesn't matter so much, because as long as it doesn't move around, you can always just cut it out if you have to. Most of the times you don't even have to. So the whole point is that, you know, you get to this stage because years ago, so we know that the size of the tumor is, you know, probably a very, very, very minor part of what causes you, the cancer, to kill you. Yet at the same time, the larger the cancer is, the more likely it is to be a more advanced tumor, which means it's more likely to spread. So you get this sort of confusion between the size, which is sort of a marker for how advanced it is, compared to the size, which is important in and of itself, right? I mean, it's a very important thing. Just like saying that, you know, gray hair, for example, is a marker of mortality, right? If you have more gray hair, you're more likely to die. And it's true, because it's a marker for age. If you're older, you're more likely to die. If you're older, you're more likely to have gray hair. But there's this confusion between sort of gray hair is going to kill you because the gray is a bad color, sort of thing, versus gray is just a marker for age. It's the same thing as size. Is it the size that's going to kill you? Or is it because the larger it is, the more likely it is to be advanced, right? And it's really that if it's bigger, it's more likely to be more advanced, and therefore you've probably had it longer, and therefore it's more likely to spread. So it's very important, because if you say that gray hair is a marker for mortality, we know that, but gray hair actually causes mortality. You make that sort of leap that horrible leap from association into causation, which we do all the time. So when you make that horrible leap into causation and say gray hair will kill you, then you say, well, I just need to dye my hair and I will reduce my mortality by 50%. Well, obviously that's not true, but we've done the same thing. So a big cancer means that it's more likely advance, which will more likely kill you. So we say, well, let's make it a smaller cancer. And that is the equivalent of dyeing your hair. It doesn't do anything, though. And we know that it doesn't do anything because, for example, in surgery, when we have a cancer that has metastasized, there's no point cutting it out or cutting it, you know, half of it, because it doesn't do anything. Yet, when we measure this sort of partial response in cancer trials, so drug trials, they say, well, we reduce the size from sort of, you know, by 50%. That's considered positive. And you can get your drug approved on the basis of these sort of measures, which is like reducing the size or something called progression-free survival, for example. And there's all these sort of logical fallacies as to why these sort of markers don't work. But what happened in the sort of, you know, in the 2000s is that the Federal Drug Administration, which approves these drugs, created this sort of expedited way of, you know, accelerating drug development. So the reason we never use these sort of markers of approving drugs is because they weren't effective, right? But in the sort of 2000s, the FDA said, well, we need more drugs. So we're going to make it easier for you to get your drug approved. So you can use these half measures like gray hair and so on. So you can use these half measures like tumor size to get your drug approved, as long as you go back and study to see if it actually improves things overall, that is overall survival. Because that's the only thing that matters, overall survival. You know, so the problem was that a lot of drugs got approved based on these surrogate measures. And they, when they look back at, you know, first, a lot of drugs never went back and to see if they're actually effective. A lot of them, when they look back, found that they weren't effective. So then they actually got pulled down from the market. And other drug companies say, well, we just won't look then, because once they're approved, we're all good. We're just selling stuff. But you're selling stuff that has never really been shown to be useful. And that's how you get into this situation. We have so many very expensive drugs that have very marginal benefits, if any benefits at all. And it's the use of these sort of surrogate outcomes. And it's the equivalent of saying, we measured gray hairs and you colored all your gray hairs black, and therefore you did really good for reducing mortality. It's the same thing. So that's the reason. In surgery, you never cut half the tumor because it's not useful. You might as well not cut any of it. In if you give a drug that reduces it by 50%, it probably doesn't do anything. And that's the sort of thing that we get into in the book, because there's all these fallacies. People say, well, if you're reducing cancer deaths as opposed to overall deaths, well, how can it not be good? So let's take an example for, you know, then this is, if you have 100 patients, for example, and, you know, they get cancer at age 60, they all die at age 65, for example. So a group of 100 patients, they get it at 60, die at 65. Now, you have, so 100% of them die of cancer. If you treat them with this drug, they, like 25% of them will die of chemotherapy-related causes. So they'll get heart attacks, they'll get infections, and so on. Now, everybody still dies at 65, so same overall effect, but now 25% have died of heart attacks and infections and whatever, and 75% have died of cancer. So now you have 75% cancer deaths versus 100% cancer death. And so you say, now my drug is useful because I've reduced my cancer deaths by 25%. You haven't reduced your overall mortality. In fact, you did harm by causing all these other deaths, when the data will actually make it look like you could actually argue that you're actually improving things, right? So that's a big problem. Same thing with lead time bias, for example. So if you, and this gets into the question of screening, for example, where if, you know, people talk about screening and they say, well, you know, how is screening bad? Because there's actually a move backing away from a lot of screening. And it's the same thing. You have this lead time bias, which is that if, say, you take a group of people that have cancer at 60, they die at age 70. So you, with screening, you discover them immediately. They survive 10 years with their cancer. Say you didn't screen them and they got it at age 60, you didn't find it till age 69, they only survived a year with cancer, 69 to 70. So you say, oh, okay, well, I improved my survival with cancer from 1 year to 10 years. But it's completely artifactual because, in fact, the both groups got it at 60, died at 70. So you see, there's all these sort of statistical things when you start to make measures that are like cancer deaths and, you know, survival with cancer and progression-free survival and all these sort of terms that get used in the development of disease that actually don't make any difference. So that's sort of where we got all these, where we got into trouble with a lot of these things, such as the screening, which we thought more screening is better. Turns out more is not always better. There's been a lot of screening that's been a complete dud, you know, and has been sort of walked back a little bit. And that's how we got to this situation with cancer therapeutics, where we got a lot of marginal improvement drugs, you know, by looking at these measures like size that just were not important in and of themselves.
Now, insulin is a growth hormone. It's a hormone we need for a lot of different purposes in our body. You know, it pulls in sugar into our muscles and our liver when we need it. It stores body fat when we need it. But insulin is also a very big problem for us, and it's intricately tied into cancer growth. And that has, you know, when you take that one step further, it's like, what control do I have actually over my insulin? And that's what I put in my mouth. So can you kind of talk us through that?
Yeah, this is the fascinating part. So again, as we're moving from a paradigm of genetic mutations to something a little bit more nuanced, like the evolutionary thing. So as cancer is an evolutionary process, almost the development of this sort of new species, then you have to say, well, if it's going to be a new species, and I say that because the human body actually recognizes cancer cells as foreign cells. So it's not our cells, right? So the human body has this innate immune system. And if you are not part of the human body, it will attack and destroy you. So bacteria that come in, the immune system will recognize it and kill the bacteria because it recognizes it as non-human. Same thing as a cancer. It will actually, if you put a cancer cell, a cancer cell develops, the human immune system will just innately, without any training, just destroy that. So it is a foreign invader almost, but it came from ourselves. So if you see that as a genetic mutation problem, then you say things like, well, what you eat doesn't make any difference because, or your lifestyle doesn't make any difference because what you eat is not mutagenic. That is, if you like to eat sugar, it doesn't cause a lot of cellular damage. If you eat a lot of, you know, refined carbohydrates, it doesn't make your genes mutate. So therefore, it shouldn't make any difference. But it turns out it makes a huge difference. And we started to recognize this sort of in the 2000s. So this is why I say a lot of what we think about cancer has changed in the last 20 years without people quite recognizing it. We found out that there's this huge link to obesity. So a lot of cancers were actually obesity related. The WHO recognizes at least 13 types of cancer as obesity related. So this was not something that we actually knew about in the past. So we actually, I went to medical school in the 1990s and we never talked about obesity as a cause of cancer. Turns out when you look at the population attributable risk, that is, you know, in a whole population of people, what percentage of risk can be attributed to, say, smoking? It's about 35%. Then you say, what can be attributed to diet? It's about 30%. So it's actually just below tobacco smoke. as an attributable risk for cancer. So it's like, wow. And it far, far, far outweighs everything else you think causes cancer, which is things like radiation and pollutants and chemicals, man-made chemicals and plastics and all that. Those all can cause cancer. But they're your population attributable risk. In a big population, it's going to be 1%, 2%, whereas diet is like 30%. Tobacco smoking is like 35%. So far outweighs everything else. And then you have to go back and say, well, what is it about this diet that is making people get cancer? And that's where you start to get into these hormones that change with your diet, things like insulin and other things. So mTOR, for example, goes up when you eat a lot of protein, and that turns out to be very involved in the cancer-making process. And, you know, 20 years ago, people would have laughed at you if you said stuff like that. But now we know that it's true. And the link is that all of these sort of diseases, sort of these hormones that are implicated in nutrition, that is, you eat, certain hormones go up, like insulin. Well, these sort of nutrient sensors, so these are specific ways that our body knows that nutrition is coming in. So mTOR is one, AMPK and insulin are the others. So insulin goes up when you eat. So we know nutrition is coming in. Turns out that they're also growth factors. That is, and the reason they're growth factors is because your body wants to grow when nutrition is available. When nutrition is not available, so if you're in the middle of famine and you're not eating anything, insulin is going to go down very low. And your body doesn't want to make more cells. They don't want the cells that are there to grow. They want the cells that are there to shrink or die. So that's the whole point, that these hormonal mediators of nutrition are actually growth factors. So it's important, because if you have a disease where you have excessive insulin, so hyperinsulinemia, which we talked about in the obesity code, the diabetes code, if you have foods that are causing you to have way too much insulin, you're going to have very high signaling for growth. That is, you're telling your body not only to store fat, but you're telling all the cells of your body, hey, you should grow because lots of food is available. Please grow, please grow. And the things that are going to grow better than anything else are those cancers. So things such as breast cancer cells are very insulin sensitive. So they're very responsive to insulin, same with colorectal. So we see this also in obesity, which is also a disease of hyperinsulinemia, where you have a huge risk increase with obesity as well as type 2 diabetes. So both diseases of hyperinsulinemia and both diseases are associated with sort of increased risk of cancer. So that's the sort of link, because you know, these are independent organisms almost, these cancer cells, but they do respond still to growth signals and nutrition. So you increase nutrition, such as you eat a lot of sugary foods, you eat a lot of highly refined carbohydrates, which really spikes your insulin up. You get into the state of obesity where you have insulin high all the time, or type 2 diabetes. Well, you're signaling increased growth, which is going to translate into an ideal sort of growing environment for cancer cells, because it's, you know, cancer is like a seed. Just because you have the seed doesn't mean that it will grow. That is, you take a seed of a plant, whatever plant you want, flower or something, it's not going to grow if you just put it in a little bag. But you put it in soil and give it water and it grows. Same thing with cancer. So the seed is there because it's actually in all of us, but it doesn't grow until you have the fertile soil, which is provided by these nutrient sensors. That is, you're giving it the nutrition, you're making nutrition available, at the same time you're signaling it to grow as much as it can. And you're in a disease of too much insulin is a disease of too much growth, which is bad for cancer.
Okay. So if knowing what we know now, and we want to reduce our risk or minimize our risk, what are some recommendations that you would make now?
Yeah, and that's a great question because I don't think there's a lot of good recommendations that we can make right now. However, the only thing you can say is that if you are overweight or obese, then you should try to lose weight because there seems to be a clear reduction in cancer because you have all these cancers that are obesity related. If you're not obese, then you're going to reduce your risk. Whether or not low-carbohydrate diets, for example, versus, say, plant-based versus, you know, paleo versus whatever diet, there's not the amount of data that you can say, well, you know, you should follow this diet. I'd love to be able to say that, but the science just doesn't allow us to. All you can say is that maintaining a normal weight is going to be very likely to reduce your risk of cancer. So that seems fairly uncontroversial, but how you lose that weight is you can't sort of at this point say this diet is better than this diet. So, you know, whatever diet works for you to lose weight, that's probably the most important thing. You know, a few other things such as fasting, will it work? Again, theoretically, fasting is going to be very, very effective for prevention of cancer. But that's all you can say, theoretically. We don't know that that's true. So fasting, of course, reduces all of your nutrient sensors. So insulin is going to go down, mTORC is going to go down, AMPK is going to go up. So it's going to affect all of them because it's not just insulin, right? There's other nutrient sensors in the body. So you're going to affect all of them simultaneously versus, say, a low-carb diet or a ketogenic diet where you're really only lowering insulin. So the point is that if you're able to lose weight, that's probably a good thing. Fasting is probably a very important part, and that's the argument I make, is that fasting is an important part of weight loss. So therefore, fasting is likely going to reduce your risk, future risk of cancer, by allowing you to maintain a normal weight. The second thing, of course, is type 2 diabetes. So type 2 diabetes also happens in people who are normal weight. So it's not just the weight, but the hyperinsulinemia. So again, fasting is going to help reduce your insulin because when you don't eat, insulin goes down. So therefore, you're reducing these sort of nutrient sensors, which is going to likely translate into a reduced risk of cancer. But that's all you can really say. You can say that theoretically this should work, but whether it actually works, you couldn't say with any confidence. There's a few other things in terms of chemo prevention. So this was a term coined by the NIH to talk about substances which will reduce cancer. And this is always interesting to people to say, well, if I eat this, I'm going to protect myself against cancer. And there's very little that actually is proven there. There's some data on metformin. So metformin is used, again, in the longevity circles. It increases AMPK, which is actually one of the nutrient sensors. So it actually signals, you know, low food availability. So if you're on metformin for type 2 diabetes, it seems that there's a lower risk of cancer than other types of diabetes treatments. So if you're a type 2 diabetic, maybe you should consider metformin. There's a little bit of data on that in terms of chemo prevention. The other one that is interesting to me, but there's not a lot of data, is green tea, because again, a lot of these compounds have been studied, mostly by the Japanese who drink a lot of green tea, that it might reduce the risk of cancer. So some of the data coming out of Japan are very interesting, but of course, it's not a randomized controlled trial. You can't say for sure that this is or isn't going to reduce cancer. But on the other hand, you know, when you look at a chemo prevention, you have to say, well, what are the risks of drinking green tea? And you have to say, well, almost nothing. I mean, people drink 5, 6, 7 cups of green tea a day. Don't seem to have any harmful effects, and it's pretty cheap. It's, you just go to the grocery store, buy a big box of green tea, and so it's pretty, seems pretty safe, seems like there's fairly inexpensive, and potentially you could lower your risk. So again, as a chemotherapeutic, as a chemo preventative agent, it's probably one of the more interesting things, but again, mostly I would that's all the science can say about that. So maintaining normal weight, and again, getting back to the obesity code and the diabetes code, you know, I think that a rational strategy involves sort of reducing carbohydrates, intermittent fasting, sort of reducing snacks and reducing processed foods.
Dr. Fung, I define wellness as being the healthiest, fittest, and happiest you can be. What are three strategies or tactics to get and stay well?
Yeah, I think that those are the main things which I cover in these sort of these books, which is it all kind of comes back to the same sort of things, which is, you know, cutting out processed foods largely. Like, you know, it's not just the processed carbohydrates, but they're the biggest culprit. But most processed foods are not going to be very good for you. So reducing processed foods, reducing the frequency of eating, because and this was different, of course, in the 1900s versus the, 2020s. We're all sort of more towards the obesity side than in the past. So therefore, we should try and bring it back in order to be healthy. And then more specifically, with regards to cancer, I think that the main thing is really just sort of maintaining this, you know, balance of understanding of what it is, so that we can, you know, and it's not just diet, of course. There's lots of other determinants, but also things such as, you know, avoiding unhealthy habits like smoking. And, you know, there's always these things in terms of stress. You should, you know, it's probably not good, the chronic stress, because it's this chronic sort of damage that happens when your cortisol is always high. So sort of maintaining this balance of diet and also the lifestyle, which is going to keep you free of cancer.
Great. So Dr. Fung, if someone wanted to learn more about you, learn more about your book, The Cancer Code, or your other books, where would you like for me to send them?
Yeah, so you can go to my website, which is thefastingmethod.com. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram. That's at Dr. Jason Fung. That's Dr. Jason Fung. Those are great ways to get in touch. And of course, you can get my books, The Cancer Code and The Obesity Code and The Diabetes Code.
Well, Dr. Fung, thank you for being a part of 40 Plus Fitness.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back, Rachel. You know, I really enjoy my conversations with Dr. Fung. He's been on a few times, but every time he's just a blunt instrument, and I just I actually appreciate that he says exactly what he means. He doesn't sugarcoat it, and he doesn't try to talk around an issue, and he's unapologetic about everything. And I actually find that very refreshing that someone has, you know, a view on this. He's done a lot of reading, a lot of research on this, and it is what it is. And that's Dr. Fung. So I always enjoy the conversations I have with him.
I appreciate his bluntness and his incredible research that he's put together. He really changed how I view cancer, and what he has discussed is incredible. So yeah. What do you think?
Well, as we look at the coronavirus as it's going, and everybody's all upset with the numbers of cases, mm-hmm. and deaths and all of that. And I'm like, mm-hmm. okay, a lot of people want to lock us up, put us in our place, you know, and just let's just wait it out for a year. Let's just stay in the mm-hmm. house for a year and not, you know, let everything else just go. And I'm like, they've never said anything like that about, well, we should do this for cancer, or we should do this for smokers, or, you know, because tobacco kills nearly 500,000 people a year. It's twice the number we're looking at with the coronavirus. And I'm like, no one said we should just ban cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. You know, similarly, the American Cancer Society put out a fact earlier that they estimate over 1 million people will be diagnosed with cancer this year. It's a lot of people.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, you know, the things we know that cause cancer, ban them, you know, mm-hmm. don't let people do them. And I'm like, no one's saying that. I'm like, well, why not? Why not? You know, it's a struggle for me, you know, when things happen. You know, Eddie Van Halen died a few weeks ago, and everybody's like, mm-hmm. oh, it's so sad. I'm like, well, he was smoker, and he mm-hmm. died of cancer, and he you know, and he was unapologetic about being a smoker. You know, he made mm-hmm. games about it. He blew smoke rings, he, you know, all those things. And you're like, well, Eddie, eventually that's going to get you. You know, Keith Richards is kind of the only person out there that seems to be immune to cancer. But, you know, I'm like, your lifestyle is determining so much of this stuff that it's, if you are a smoker, don't get mad at me. Just figure out a way to stop.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that lifestyle aspect, because in this podcast, and I think one of your prior ones, the analogy you discussed in this podcast was that of a seed, in that you can buy seeds for your garden, for example, and if they sit in the packet that you buy them in, they remain a seed and it's sitting there inert and useless. But if you give them a place to grow, the right soil, the right nutrients, and then they grow, and how similar that is to cancer. And this is a new way to look at cancer that I've never thought of before, in that it exists in our bodies as a seed. And if it remains inert, well, that's good for us as a human. But if we did give it the nutrients to grow, then that's when it becomes a problem. And Dr. Fong had mentioned that we know, based on all of the cancer research that has been done to date, we know that about 35% of risk factor can be contributed to smoking. So if you're a smoker, you've got a 35% greater chance of developing cancer. And in that same sentence, he mentioned similarly that having obesity increases our chances of cancer by 30%. So those, smoking and obesity, are two of those nutrients that can cause cancer to grow. So what can we do about that?
Well, you know, one is to try to get yourself to a healthy weight. And I know that that's, you know, again, that upsets people a lot when they hear, okay, well, no, you know, no weight is definitely unhealthy. And it's time and time again, these studies come out and show, well, technically it is. You know, if you have a BMI that puts you in the obesity column, you very likely are carrying extra fat. And if that fat, particularly is visceral fat, you have a bit of a problem for heart disease. And if that fat is in your body, and this is something a lot of folks don't recognize, is body fat emits estrogen. And estrogen can feed cancer. So, you know, those linkages are there. So every pound of fat you lose, you're improving the environment that that cancer could grow in. So you're basically making sure that the soil is not sterile. I mean, the soil is not going to give the nutrients to the cancer that it needs. So every pound of body fat that you're able to lose is going to make you healthier and put you at less risk. It's just the reality of it. And again, you know, if you get the book, I encourage you to get the book. Particularly if you know that you're in a high risk group, it's a really good read. All of his books in his wellness, what he calls the wellness code trifecta, I guess at this point, or the series, the obesity code. I had him on for that. I had his assistant Megan on for the diabetes code, and then now I've had Dr. Fung for this, and I had him also on for the fasting book with Jimmy Moore. And in all of the books, you know, they talk about lowering your sugar. The amount of sugar you're eating. They talk about intermittent fasting and fasting as protocols to help. So they're you know, the tools are there. And pretty much at this point, I'd say Dr. Fung has laid out a roadmap to kind of help you understand why these things are happening, why diabetes is getting bigger and bigger, and why every time I turn on the television now that I'm in the United States, I'm seeing drugs about diabetes. You know, before I left, we were seeing a lot of drugs about heart disease. But now I'm seeing diabetes and joint pain, arthritis. And, you know, again, it's just that, what are you eating? What are you putting into your body that's raising your blood sugar and doing those things? Don't take a pill to lower your blood sugar. Figure out what's causing your blood sugar to go up and try to eliminate that from your food sources. And there's tools to do that. In fact, that was one of the ads I saw. You basically put this thing on your arm and it stays on there for 14 days and gives you your blood sugar without having to prick your finger. You just tap your phone to it and it gives you the number. Now, the number they flashed on the screen, the woman was at 112 and that was down from where her peak was. And I was like, look at that number. I'm like, whoa.
Yeah.
You know, this woman's walking around with blood sugar way into the 160s, 170s after she eats. And she's just making sure she's not still that high. And she's about to order her food at a restaurant. I'm like, okay, but you that meal you ate earlier today, that you need to go look at that, because mm-hmm. if 112 is your low, that's way high, and I'm pretty sure her A1C is not where she wants it to be. And so the whole commercial, I was like, okay, this is, I'm living in bizarro land where people are, you know, they know their blood sugar and they're still eating the way they're eating. And then again, that the blood sugar, and it's not necessarily a one for one that the blood sugar is fueling your cancer, but mm-hmm. a lot of cancers can't survive without adequate glucose. And if your brain is telling it, you know, okay, this is where we need the glucose, it's less likely that you're going to be growing the tumor. Mm-hmm. But again, as we talked in Dr. Fung, the size of the tumor isn't necessarily the problem. It's how fast that cancer is moving, spreading. Mm-hmm. And that's where the big problems come in. So being healthy, doing the right things for your body, changing the environment that cancer exists in mm-hmm. is going to go a long way towards making sure that you beat it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the easy start is to watch what you're eating, just like you said, to limit, like Dr. Fung said, to limit the refined carbs and all the excess sugars. I mean, if you read labels, it's not that hard to make some healthier swaps. But I also feel, as an athlete myself, that exercising would really help you use all of that excess glucose as well. I mean, no one's saying you got to be keto or low carb or no carb or no sugar. But if you're eating things like that, then you should time some movement, some exercise, some running or walking or something to burn off as much glucose as you can.
Yeah. And you know, I'm God that's going to say it. If it has a label, you probably shouldn't be eating it. if it's in a box, a bag, a jar, or a can, mm-hmm. it's going to have a label because they're obligated to put the label on there. And that is going to tell you how much sugar's in it. Mm-hmm. But I would rather you get your sugar from an apple or for some berries or even from a banana. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and some vegetables and fruits, you know, the other fruits like tomatoes and avocados mm-hmm. and things like that. You do much better for that to be where your sugar's coming from. Mm-hmm. But if it's in a box, bag, jar, or can, the less of that you eat, the healthier you're going to be. No one has mm-hmm. ever gotten fat eating whole food.
No,
you can't. No one can prove to me that anyone has ever gotten fat when they ate whole food.
Real food.
Yeah, real food. Well, yeah. I have to call it whole food because the food makers would say, well, it's food. And it's like, okay, mm-hmm. so is dog food, well, kibble.
That's true.
The dog sometimes doesn't like it. So
that is also true.
Kibble or a steak, and the dog always chooses steak every single time. All right. So I did want to say one thing, you know, because again, I know you you do some fundraising for cancer research, yes. and I'm actually doing one now, and I'd like to encourage all the listeners, anyone listening to this, to sign up for the Sloth Race 5K. You can do a 5K or 10K. I'm actually going to do the 10K towards the end of this month when I get really back and settled into Bocas. I'm going to do my 5K. They mail the shirt and the medal to you. So it's pretty simple. You do this on your own, at your own pace, at your own time. And, you know, then you've run your 5K, your Sloth 5K. And so if you go to 40plusfitnesspodcast.com/race, R-A-C-E, that's going to take you to their sign up page. So you can sign up to join me on the race. And if you do the race, take a picture with the shirt. They're actually pretty cool looking shirts because, of course, they have a sloth on them. And everybody loves sloths. Take a picture and post it on our group page. You know, just go post a picture and say, I did the sloth race with the 40 plus fitness team. And I'd love to see those pictures because they are donating to an organization called Stand Up to Cancer. So if this episode resonated with you, if this podcast resonates with you, join us on this 5K. Again, it's your pace, your time, 5K, 10K, doesn't matter, whichever you prefer. And then post it on the group that you completed the run. And I'd love to see those posts start coming in.
Yep. Mike and I are going to do it as well. I'm signing him up for the 10K. Both of us will do the 10K.
Awesome. That's great. All right, Raz, if there's nothing else we need to talk about, I'll see you next week.
Thanks. Thanks so much.
Next time on the 40 Plus Fitness Podcast, we meet Rosie Mercado and discuss her book, The Girl with Self-Esteem Issues. Until then, have a happy and healthy week.